Hello, welcome. I'm Susie Jones. And if you have a question for our guest today, after the show, during the show, whatever time, you can email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Also, this number, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can write it down and put it on your refrigerator, 651-461-9226. But now, here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor Bruce Helmer and senior vice president and financial advisor Peg Webb. Hello and welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Bruce. I don't know. Do we have Bruce? He was right there. We checked. We hear a funny noise. Peg, we're going to attempt to get Bruce. Is he back on? Not quite. We're working to get Bruce dialed back up, Peg. But we're going to talk, as he's getting back on the air, Peg, about investment markets and how it's been performing year over year. And I know with all the stock market volatility, at least in early August, a lot of us were worried about that. And what should we do as investors as we continue to work to get Bruce back up? We might want to talk a little bit about that. Peg?
Yes. So two times a year, we bring in an expert in the roundtable of Wealth Enhancement Group on our investment team. And so today we're doing a market and strategy update. And I just want to say, you know, August so far has been kind of rocky. But I'm thrilled with the performance year to date on the stock market. And I like the fixed income markets, but there's been some increased volatility. And so we wanted to bring in a guest, Tim Insko, from our portfolio management team, and he's part of this team that helps with comprehensive financial planning when it comes to investments that are well positioned for our clients. So he has 15 years of investment experience. He's instrumental in establishing Wealth Enhancement Group's first ever fundamental investment research team, which has added that to our investment department equity research capabilities. So kudos to Tim there. But prior to joining Wealth Enhancement Group, Tim was a portfolio manager at Hawkins Wealth Management in North Liberty, Iowa. And before that, he was the head of equity research in London. So welcome, Tim. Today, we're happy to have you because I think a lot of listeners, you know, with all the volatility that we had the last couple of weeks and the election, this show is very timely. Tim?
Yep, I'm here.
And Bruce is also on. I want to bring Bruce in too, Peg, just because he's back on to say hello and good morning. Bruce, you're on our phone line now, but just so Peg knows, you're here with us as well. And Tim is also on the line. So there you go.
Yeah. Hi, Peg. Hi, Susie Jones. And thanks for being on, Tim. We appreciate it. I apologize, you guys. Something happened to my timeline, and I called in on a landline. Good to be with everyone. Tim, we're glad to have you, man. People are nervous about the recent volatility. People are nervous. They're always nervous on presidential election years. Help people calm down today, can you, buddy?
I will do my best. I guess the technical term is weird, right?
Yeah.
Morning, Peg.
Good morning. So the last market review we did 6 months ago, there has been some changes. And so let's tackle this question first. I thought it'd be worthwhile to step back and look at the last year so far. As you know, and Bruce knows, last year witnessed several events that were generally supportive of investment markets, including a strong labor market, generally good news on the inflation front. Can you kind of just recap the last 6 months, and then we'll go to present how we think about the markets today?
Sure. Thanks, Peg. Before I begin, I'm going to add the caveat that my comments reflect the current outlook from Wealth Enhancement Group and obviously subject to change as circumstances change which they can and do frequently. So let's review the setup from last year or so. As you just stated, resilient labor market in spite of some slowing in the economy. Generally good news on the inflation front and really how the Fed has managed the expectations. There's been a lot of use of verbiage and talk to manage the expectations there. Return of materially higher interest rates, shifting the risk-reward profile for fixed income. In general, I'd say the markets have continued along this path for the last 6 months or so, or for the first 6 months of the year anyway. Positive returns in the tech sector, along with some higher growth stocks, helped close out a strong first half. Strong stock performance in the U.S. continued across most indices, except, you know, small cap, blue chips to a certain extent, but those are still pretty good. Investors seem content with modest rate cut expectations. Growth and inflation continue to moderate, and bonds have been performing much as you'd expect, given what the Fed has been signaling.
You know, I feel like most clients and friends and people that I talk to just think, oh, this market is sensational. And then all of a sudden, you know, what went wrong kind of in later July, earlier this month?
Well, I think it starts with U.S. equity markets trading near all-time highs in mid-July. And with that, high valuations, and on top of that, the winners were highly concentrated in the sectors of the economy that stood to benefit from artificial intelligence or AI, really tech heavy. The high valuations and the high concentration with those things combined, conditions had to be perfect for it to continue higher, really. So therefore, the risk of pullback was already building just by nature of that run-up. So with that backdrop, there appear to be two primary triggers for what we witnessed. And one was the sell-off in the Japanese markets and the unwind of the so-called yen carry trade. This forced some U.S. selling. And then the second cause, from our perspective, was likely the perceived softness in labor markets. The two coincided on August 2nd, which was a Friday, when weaker than expected jobs report added to the concerns that the U.S. economy might be headed for a slowdown. If you recall, the payrolls were 114,000 versus an expectation of 175,000 jobs added for July. And then over the weekend, going into Monday, Japanese sell-offs had begun to accelerate and really crescendoed with a 12% drop going into Monday, August 5th. The S&P 500 declined 5.7%. The Russell 2000, the smaller companies, declined 6.5% in those first two trading days of August after posting a 10.1% in July. From its mid-July peak through August 5th, so over that weekend and into that first part of August, the S&P lost 8.5%. Tech-heavy NASDAQ was hit particularly hard with that concentration, down 11.8% from its peak in mid-July through August 1st. And that's technical correction territory, technical term. But I would like to add that even with the recent pullback, markets are still very, you know, very much performing well, notably higher year-to-date. And just had their best week of the year this last week, which is a good reminder why portfolio diversification and sticking with a plan are so important.
Tim, you know, I thank you for saying that at the end. I was actually kind of formulating in my head my next question or comment, and then you kind of went there. I think, you know, Peg, you said something earlier that people are generally happy. I find that people generally see the economy, and this is going to probably segue into something we're going to talk about before we're done today, but they see it based on their political views. I've had a lot of people come in that are right-leaning or Republican that think the economy is horrible, and I'm like, well, the stock market's at an all-time high, and GDP has been good, and unemployment is low, but the perception is, if they're a political candidate, is not the one that's in power, or then things are bad. And conversely, if you're happy with who's in the Oval Office, then you see the world really, really good. And it's unfortunate that we can't be, or people overall can't be more objective. But Tim, you just said it, even after that retraction, even after that pullback, we've had a good year in the market. Here's one of the questions I'm getting a lot, or Peg has actually talked about this a lot on the show, Tim. We talked about AI last week, but so much of the market, you mentioned the NASDAQ is tech heavy, but the S&P 500 is also big tech heavy. Many of these companies are betting on the future of AI. Can you add anything? Peg and I had a discussion last week, but investment management, what's your viewpoint of AI, and how is that going to impact the markets, and how is that going to impact our listeners and their 401k and retirement plans?
Of course. The impact and perceived impact of AI on the markets is certainly worth discussing, probably over and over again at this point. Potential applications of AI have created a huge demand for high-end semiconductors, memory, power, et cetera, et cetera. Anything data center related. The term we've been using in-house is AI factory infrastructure, because it really is very factory-like. So with that, the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 are more concentrated by market cap than anything we've seen since the dot-com period. Right now, we're at 37% of the index versus 27% at that point. So the difference between now and then, though, is that today's companies are far more profitable, representing about 27% of the S&P 500's earnings, according to JP Morgan. So, you know, it's not quite the, you know, look but don't see kind of situation of the dot-com. As an example of the impact, NVIDIA gained more than 150% at the end of June and was responsible for a third of the market's performance in mid-year. Still, the companies have heightened earnings expectations with that. And in July, some analysts were bothered by the lack of transparency regarding when and whether the benefits of spending tens of billions on AI would pan out. So that's kind of where we are with that.
What's interesting, Tim, is the stock markets in the United States and abroad have been strong year to date, virtually across the board. What do we see? Let's be a little bit futuristic here. What do we see upcoming? I know we're going to talk a little bit about the election, but what else do we see coming?
So you're right. Stock markets in the U.S. and abroad, international, have been strong through this part of the year already. Corrections of this magnitude, so what we saw in July and early August, occur pretty frequently in both bull and bear markets, so that's normal. Even considering the recent pullback, the S&P and NASDAQ 100 are up 16.5% and 16% respectively year-to-date. Even the less tech-heavy Dow Jones and developed international stocks are both up around 8% or so. The laggard is the Russell 2000, which is up just under 6%. So in spite of the choppiness, I still think there's some upside, some strength, and potential for broadening within, you know, some of those sectors that have not seen the early runs that we have in tech, and you're starting to see that now.
So, Tim, we've been kind of dancing.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Bruce.
No, go ahead, Peg. I'm sorry.
I was just going to add to that. I think there's some sleepers out there. The more that I read and the information that the investment team within Wealth Enhancement Group gives us, I like how you use the word sleepers. I haven't heard that for a while. So, you know, we always hear the big names, and then there's other stocks out there that are going to maybe continue this momentum. Bruce?
I just was going to kind of shift gears. We've been dancing around this a little bit, but I'm going to, you know, ask him directly. The election now is, what, less than 3 months away. Tim, what if the wrong person wins? What if that crazy no good person from the other party wins the election, not only am I going to have to get out of the stock market because my retirement plan is going to fail, I might have to move out of the country. What do you tell these people?
Yes, Bruce. Election cycles are all full of emotions and stories and biases, but more often than not, it's the overreaction to that near-term news cycle that can have a very, very negative impact on investment results. So I guess here's a couple things to keep in mind. Over the long term, U.S. stocks have tended to move up regardless of whether Republican or Democrat wins the White House. One thing we've been saying internally is businesses still find ways to make money and they're still motivated to produce earnings. Anxious investors often move to the sidelines during an election year when they perceive that the other party is going to crush them. But staying on the sidelines has not really been a great strategy. The S&P 500 has had only two negative return years in the last 20 election years, and that was 2000 and 2008. And I think we can safely say that both declines were more attributable to asset bubbles, dot-com, and housing than political maneuvering. As we say all the time, time in the market is more important than, and typically more successful than, timing the market. Beyond that, I happen to know that our advisors create plans that are well beyond a single election cycle.
Yeah. So as we look at the outlook for 2024, this is the part I've been waiting for. What are the opportunities?
So the investment team continues to have confidence in the markets for the rest of the year. Corporate earnings on the whole have not yet hit a wall. And I think there's some broadening out of belief in the rest of the market. We like to say the 490, so we talk about the top 10 all the time, but the 490 have not fallen off a cliff. Consensus earnings estimates call for continued profit growth. The recent sell-off has flushed out some of the overexuberance and complacency. Still, as the events of early August reminded us, it's important not to get overexuberant. Complacency is certainly an investor's worst enemy. Investors had been pinning their hopes on lower interest rates. When they didn't materialize in July, the trend chasers tended to head for the exits. The historical performance of NVIDIA and other tech leaders cannot and will not last forever. If your listeners want to pick up some heavy or light reading, take a look at competitive advantage period and base rates. Very interesting, given the run-up of some of these companies. Volatility seems likely to remain for the foreseeable future, though, especially given an election year in the U.S. that's been unusual, to say the least. Diversification, really important. Investors need to look beyond mega cap, which we've said a number of times, and look beyond tech, help reduce the potential impact of further drawdowns. And it's important to rebalance opportunistically, redistribute that risk exposure, you know, take a look at things beyond what's run up. I know we can get emotional about some stocks that we bought and being right, but, you know, opportunistic rebalancing is a de-risker. In addition, I think economic growth is moderating but not falling off a cliff. Soft landing scenario still seems more likely than not, but that could change depending on how much the labor market cools. That and a slowing consumer and maybe slowing consumer confidence, depleted household savings would indicate lower economic growth. Investors need to be mindful but not consumed by looming uncertainties. November election is obviously one of those. Tension in the Middle East, Taiwan, China, etc. Managing risk is paramount. So the core holdings should be high-quality companies that can withstand further economic downturns or softening, things like that. Strong balance sheets, good earnings, repeatable earnings, not just one-time items. And again, I'm going to pound the table on this. Stick with the plan. I think all of our advisors are adept at creating really, really strong plans for their clients, and it's proven itself worthwhile over the long term and through situations like this and volatile years and good years and bad years. It's, you know, the plan is what really matters.
Tim, that's a great point. And Susie, I'm keeping an eye on the clock here. I know we're about due for a break. When we come back from the break, everyone, it's a great day to ask questions about investing. We've got Tim from our investment management team. We'll tie a bow around the discussion, but a lot of the second half of the show, Susie, hopefully, is listeners' questions.
All right. We want to remind people, if you are listening, a couple of questions coming in right now about capital gains tax and the like, which is scary to a lot of people. But if you're listening right now and you have a question for Tim or Bruce or Peg, the number is 651-461-9226. That will get you right on the line with our friends here. 651-461-9226. We're talking about market strategy. 651-461-9226. Welcome back to Your Money, and reminding you once again, if you have a question for our guests, then you want to call later, you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 1-888-6-ADVICE. And always, you can email questions to wealthenhancement.com, yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Once again, here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, Bruce Helmer, and senior vice president and financial advisor, Peg Webb. Welcome back to both of you and our special guest.
Thank you, and that's the wonderful Susie Jones. Thank you, Susie. Thank you, listeners, for hanging in there. If you joined us late, we're fortunate to have with us today Tim Insko. Tim is a portfolio manager at Wealth Enhancement Group. He's part of the team that devises and creates our comprehensive financial planning and investment strategies. Tim's been in the industry over 15 years. If you were listening in the first half of the show, you can tell he's a really smart guy. And so we've been talking about the markets, where they've been, where we think they're going. And Tim is always careful to preface that our outlook today could change based on circumstances. We still have things going on in the world that are of concern. The war continues to rage in Ukraine, Gaza. We don't know what's going to happen between Israel and Iran. So there's always things in the world that could change the outlook. But, Tim, maybe that's a good question to start with. Every time it seems like we have an event like that, something serious, again, human nature maybe being what it is, or maybe it's influenced by media, people seem to think that markets will collapse, everything will go bad. And you know, we point out that we've seen things before. We've seen assassination attempts, assassinations, wars, all kinds of things. And markets are very resilient in the long term. And one of the things that I get is, well, this time it's different. But again, when we look at a history of the markets, despite the fact that there's potentially volatility in the short term, historically, long term, stocks have rewarded investors. And from our perspective, I'm sure you're going to say, Tim, there's no reason not to think that that won't continue to occur. Yes?
Absolutely correct. One of the things that I enjoy is reading market history. If you've ever read the Berkshire Hathaway letters going back decades and decades, you start to realize that every time we say this time is different, it's just a flavor of what's happened in the past. And, you know, even the inflation stuff, you read Uncle Warren's comments over the years, and, you know, we've seen this. We've seen this. And it's, again, it's just a different flavor of what we've seen in the past. So, yes, markets are very, very resilient over the long term. We've got hundreds and hundreds of years of history showing that it's typically up and to the right over the long term. So you're absolutely correct, Bruce.
Well, and I think sometimes people lose sight of what we're actually investing in. You know, we throw all these numbers at them. The Dow is up this much. The S&P is up this much. The NASDAQ did this. The global markets. But at the end of the day, people are investing in companies. And presumably, hopefully, we're investing or coaching them to invest in efficient, creative, innovative, well-run companies that will increase in value over time. There may be blips along the way. That's to be expected. Nothing, you know, goes up all the time. But let's not forget what we're actually coaching them to invest in. They have ownership of hopefully really well-run companies.
And companies that are seeking to maximize their efficiency, maximize their returns, hopefully not over-leverage themselves, which is something we keep an eye on. And, you know, that's why you have people that do the research and people that do the work, because they are generally able to keep an eye on those things and watch the incentives, watch the motivations, watch how management teams react to the different inputs that are coming at them from the macro environment or the political environment or what have you. So that's really important, is following along and keeping an eye on those things. You can do it yourself, but there's a lot of things you can do yourself that can be done more efficiently if somebody else is steering the car or driving the bus. So I think a lot of those things, you do have to keep that in mind, is these are companies that are being run for profit, for return, and, you know, they're going to take these things and adjust to whatever comes at them.
Hey, Peg, before we get listeners involved. Sorry, Peg, I was going to say, before we get listeners involved, do you want to ask Tim another question, or do you have key thoughts, key takeaways for listeners? Peg, sorry.
Well, I actually get this question all the time. You know, there's these growth stocks and there's these value stocks. And it's a little fuzzy right now because it used to be the growth stocks were all tech stocks without any dividend. And now we're actually seeing that the tech companies, which are on the growth side, start to get dividends. And so clients are asking us, that's kind of a big change. Can you comment on that, Tim?
It is and it isn't. You look at some companies across the world, and some of the growth companies across the world have paid dividends for a while. What's happening now, from our perspective, is that a lot of these growth companies, you know, so-called growth companies, are throwing off so much cash that it's not prudent just to try to spend it and spend it inefficiently. So they're returning a big chunk of that to shareholders, whether that's through buybacks or dividends. And let's not forget, a lot of these companies were already doing buybacks. So it's just another form of returning capital to shareholders. Dividends are more visible, certainly. So it is a change, but it's not a monumental paradigm shifting change. It's just another form of returning cash to shareholders, which is what companies should do when they're throwing off this much cash.
Bruce?
Peg, or Tim, or both of you, any last key thoughts that you want to share before we let listeners drive the rest of the show?
I'll let Peg go, and then I can...
Oh, I'm good. Tim, you go ahead.
Sure. So, I think it's just prudent to stay aware and try to take emotions out of the investing process as best you can. I think that's always been a strong takeaway for long-term success, is try to remove your emotions as much as possible. And that's really hard to do, which is why the plan is so important and why research is so important. You know, remain resilient in the face of emotion. And, you know, again, time in the market is more important than trying to time the market.
Well said, Tim. And Peg and I, if we said it once, we've said it 1,000 times over the years. Your long-term money, your money that you don't need anytime soon, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, retirement plan money, should be mostly or completely in stocks, and your short-term money, money you're going to spend in the next 6 months or year or 2 years, probably should not ever be in the stock market. And again, it gets back to what Tim talked about earlier in terms of diversification and having a plan. And, you know, Tim, I think, and Peg, every time there's volatility or a retraction, people want some kind of a magic answer, and they don't want to hear, well, just stay the course or stay with your plan. They want something special, but that's the right answer. We're going to give the right answer, and the right answer is stick with your plan.
Sometimes the right answer is boring.
All right, Susie, let's let the listeners drive the rest of the show.
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, is dollar cost averaging still the best strategy in the market? And I will throw it to whomever wants to speak, but one at a time. Peg?
Sure. Dollar cost averaging, let's just define what that is. So if you have $10,000 and you're trying to decide, should I invest it today and just invest the entire $10,000 and hope that the timing is right, then if it's long-term money, you know, who cares? But now when it's kind of rocky and the markets are always, in my whole career, have been rocky, and you don't have that crystal ball to know where the valuation or the value of the stock's going to be, a strategy called dollar cost averaging just means, well, let's just take it and invest that $10,000 over a year or 10 months, where you put $1,000 in each month, hoping that you catch some highs and you catch some lows. Hopefully you catch a lot of lows. But it's kind of more of a psychology thing with people. If I can't get them to invest, and I feel like they should be, then it's a strategy to allow them to kind of have pillow power or sleep at night because they feel like they're catching some different valuations every single month. What I tell people, though, is if you want to go with that strategy and all of a sudden we have a big downturn in the market, you can always advance those monthly contributions and put it in all at that same time. So I'm a fan of dollar cost averaging, but only when you feel like it may be not long-term money. Because if it's long-term money, I always just say, why not just put it in? The longer you're in, the more you're going to average, you know, your dollars that you actually put in on a particular day. Bruce?
Yeah, I've always thought of dollar cost averaging as more of a defensive strategy than necessarily an efficiency strategy. And it gets back, you know, to people's risk tolerance. Peg, you and I and Tim and everyone in our industry can talk about the stock market and long term, how well it's done and so forth. But if somebody's had a bad experience or they just have a low risk tolerance, there's nothing wrong with using defensive strategies like dollar cost averaging to mitigate some of the risk. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. That's the number to call if you want to ask a question directly or you want to ask a text question. Again, it is 651-461-9226. Jack is on our line, our telephone line from Jenkins, Minnesota. Hello, Jack. Go ahead with your question for Bruce, Peg, and Tim this morning.
Good morning, panel. I'm calling to ask about the IRA withdrawals traditional. When do we have to start drawing that out? I am at age 72. Thanks for your answers today, panel, and a great show.
Thanks for calling, listening, and your good question. So, Peg, I think this is, again, not that Tim can't jump in, but this is a planning question more than an investment question. I think Jack is referring to required minimum distributions. Peg?
Yeah, I'm not surprised that we're getting quite a few questions on this because the rules have changed dramatically. And it used to be for a very long time that a required minimum distribution, you have all your IRAs and you've been deferring and making money on your money without paying any taxes and unless you took withdrawals. But at this point, the IRS says at certain age, 70 and a half, you had to take required minimum distribution. So the idea there was we can't have a Rockefeller effect where people are just rolling this money and rolling, compounding, never paying tax. So they came up with this idea. Well, a couple times recently, they've actually extended the age. So now the rule is at 73 years old. So if you're 72, Jack, you've got till you're 73 years old, and then you'll have to do a calculation. And a lot of times the companies where you have the assets custodianed will give you the number of the dollar amount that you have to take out. Now, not everybody has all their IRAs at one custodian. So what you can do is take the dollar amount from each custodian IRA, and then you can just take the assets or the dollars from one custodian. So 73 is the age right now. But believe it or not, they've already calculated that someone that's younger today, that they'll have even a longer time up to 75 years old to take out that money. Bruce?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is, required minimum distribution is really a mortality calculation. So the older you get, the higher that percentage is. So you have to recalculate it every year once you hit the number. And I'm not trying to do a commercial for us, but and Peg referenced this, but one of the advantages of consolidation and getting things under one roof is if you have multiple IRAs with multiple custodians, it can complicate figuring out what your required minimum distribution is. For our clients, if their IRAs are all with us, we do that calculation, we tell them what the number is, and we tell them where the best place is to take it from, and that may change from year to year. The best place to take your RMD this year might not be the best place next year, but we, for our clients, we handle that completely. Susie?
Yeah, we have another caller. Wayne is on the line to ask you a question. Go ahead, Wayne. You're on with Bruce, Peg, and Tim. Go ahead. And Wayne, turn your radio down because I can hear it in the background. That will disrupt you and your question. Are you there, Wayne? I think we're having a little trouble. He's trying to get to his radio to get to his question. I hear him. All right. Well, we can move on, guys. Sorry about that. Another texter wondered about, and my text line just went down. He wondered about what is the best time to start taking. He has money in 401k. He's living off pension and Social Security, and he has money in his 401k, and he wants to know when to start taking it out at 70 and when he should start moving it into more safer stocks. When's a point where you, and that's a pretty common question. So you've got your money. When do you move it from more of a risk standpoint to a safer spot as you get closer to retirement?
Yeah, thank you, Susie. Boy, we're having a lot of gremlins of technology today, aren't we? So, Peg, this is a common theme, and Tim can weigh in on this also, but there's several questions here in terms of when do I start taking distributions? Where's the best place? We talked about long-term money staying in stocks, but when is it no longer long-term? So my retirement plan is long-term when I'm in my growth years, my 40s or my 50s. But as I get closer to required minimum distribution, or I'm going to take withdrawals before I hit that age to maintain my lifestyle, replace my paycheck, when do I start to get more conservative? Kind of unwind all that. We've got about 3 minutes, I think. Peg?
Well, one of the things that I coach clients and actually even friends about is that there's certain tax ramifications of your money. And one is that many, many people do a tax deferral on their growth through 401ks, like this texter mentioned. And when you do that, you come up with a kind of a big IOU to the IRS. So depending on your situation, taking money out of your 401k could be as early as 59 and a half because you don't have any penalty. We're coaching clients all the time about trying to time taking money out, creating taxable income before you have this required minimum distribution at 73. So I wanted to talk about that. So the timing of taking it could be based on your own taxes and your tax return and your income, when you turn on your pension, when you turn on your Social Security, all intertwined in trying to control your taxation. So I think the biggest point there is being knowledgeable about, you know, how much you should take. Now, many people just say, oh, I'm not taking a dollar out until I'm 73. I don't mind if I have this big IOU to the IRS. Well, you will mind when that bucket of money is your only source of income along with your pension and Social Security and how much tax you're going to pay down the road. Bruce?
Tim, I want to give it back to you just because I feel like we've ignored you the last couple of questions. We've got maybe a minute and a half. Either on that text question, do you want to offer anything in terms of investments as time horizon shortens? Or if you want to just ignore that question, key takeaway that you, if you left no other message today with our listeners about the markets and about investment management, what do you think is the key thing that people need to remember from today's show, either and or both of those, Tim?
I think the key takeaway relates to the question is it's not just the markets, stocks, bonds, et cetera, different asset classes. It's how your investments interact with your tax situation. It's how your investments interact with your lifestyle and interact with your time horizon. All those things are enormous complexity beyond just trying to time the stock market or pick the right stocks. Those are all wonderful things and things that I enjoy, the research side of things and investigating markets and things like that. But really, it's far more complex than that. It's how those things interact with your life. And that's always been my big takeaway. And that comes back to you and Peg, right? Mm.
Tim, that's a great way to end. Tim Insko, thank you so much for your time. I know Peg would concur with what you just said. Susie, that's a great way to end the show.
All right, very good. We want to thank everyone for texting and calling in today. If you did not get your question answered, you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That number is 1-888-6-ADVICE. Or you can always email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Again, that's yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Make it a great day.